This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. The television version of this show airs on Free Speech TV every weekday at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern. FSTV is on Dish Network, DirecTV, and Roku. A Washington Post article in mid-October entitled, "Poor Kids Who Do Everything Right Don't Do Better Than Rich Kids Who Do Everything Wrong," points out the fallacy of the American dream. Wealthy Americans are so much more able to give their children an edge in educational and employment arenas that no matter how hard poor children work, no matter how smart they may be, they almost never reach the heights occupied by the nation's most privileged. That idea is the basis of a new documentary by political comedian John Fugelsang. Fugelsang went on a road trip, retracing the path of the great French philosopher and student of American democracy, Alexis de Tocqueville. What he found confirms our suspicions that there is no such thing as a meritocracy in the United States. John Fugelsang now joins me to discuss his new documentary, Dream On. Welcome to the show, John.
What a pleasure, Sonali. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us. So you started out on this whole journey when you yourself found yourself among the ranks of the unemployed, as many middle class or even upper middle class Americans did when the recession first hit. Was it that you sort of finally, or for the first time, really got a strong taste of what so many poor Americans had that you then were able to sort of relate to it personally and begin this journey?
That's a very good way of putting it, Sonali. Thank you. When you're in my field of entertainment, you'll have some years where you make a lot of money and you'll have some years where it's pretty lean. I'm sure a lot of your viewers are well aware of that. So in this case, I was working for a TV channel doing a public interest news show, which was also comedy based. And we were talking all about the issues facing hardworking Americans of declining wages, declining upward mobility, increasing inequality, and really, for me, the greatest culprit, 35 years of dramatically uneven income growth in this country, where the rich keep getting richer, the poor keep getting poorer. 150 Americans now have as much wealth as the bottom half, 150 million of the population. And for many, the middle class is just the top of the bottom. And so I was doing this TV show talking about these issues. And then, of course, my network was sold to a foreign buyer. Around this time, two-time Oscar-nominated filmmaker Roger Weisberg came to me with this idea he had about retracing the journey of de Tocqueville. And I thought, well, I've been doing a TV show about these issues. How can I turn down a chance to go on the road and actually meet people who are struggling with these sort of issues, the kind of people that I talk about on my TV show and in my stand-up act, but I never actually get to meet. And so I thought it was a good bit of storytelling to tie my own personal situation in with the journey.
And so remind us who Alexis de Tocqueville was and what his view and interpretation of the historic America was that sets the framework for your trip. And of course, we should remember that even when there was a time in the U.S. that that people were able to reach great heights from down below, that was only available for white men.
Exactly right. I always say the history of America has never been conservative versus liberal. It's always been aristocracy against democracy, which I'm sure a lot of free speech TV viewers can relate to. In 1831, young Alexis de Tocqueville, I think he was only 26 or so, was sent by the French government, a monarchy he despised, to come to the young nation of America and travel the country and write a detailed report on our prison system. He actually visited Sing Sing Prison in New York State, which is one of the places we filmed. De Tocqueville spent 9 months on horseback traveling around the young country and documenting our prison system. But along the way, he began documenting every facet of American life. And as someone who came from essentially a feudal system in France, a very, very diehard caste system, where if you were born wealthy, you were expected to stay wealthy. If you were born poor, you were expected to stay poor. De Tocqueville pointed out that religion was the first time in European history that a poor-born person could hope to rise in stature in society and one day hobnob with the wealthiest castes. When he came here and saw this society where not only did people believe you could work hard and play by the rules and rise on the economic ladder and give your children a better standard of living than you had enjoyed, he saw people doing it. He saw this actually happening. He saw people achieving wealth, losing wealth, going up and down the economic ladder, going from prosperity to poverty and going from poverty to what's now called the middle class. He fell deeply in love with this concept of equality and upward mobility. He actually said no American is immune of a desire to rise, a yearning desire to rise, which shows it's not uniquely an American dream, it's a human dream. But he went back to France and wound up compiling all of his notes into the book Democracy in America, which really planted the seeds for what became the American dream. I read it in college. It's still a very, very timely book almost 200 years later. In the 1994 midterms, here in the States, both Newt Gingrich and Bill Clinton would quote de Tocqueville in speeches against each other, which shows how, you know, the liberals claim him as their own, the conservatives, the libertarians. I read the book in sociology class in college. So the idea behind the film was to retrace his same journey and do in like 2.5 months in a car what it took him 9 months on horseback. And in every city we visited, speak to Americans of every possible background about what the American dream was, what it is now, and what it could be. And along the way, we filmed in prisons, in hospitals, in the worst homeless shelter in New York, in Detroit. We filmed in rural obesity clinics in the Mississippi Delta, Indian reservations in the Carolinas that have completely turned their tribes' economic fortunes around due to an even disbursement of casino money. We were witnessing protesters being arrested outside the Boston Housing Court for protesting no-fault evictions. We met so many people who lost their homes in the crash and realized that in many cases, the bank didn't want them to pay. They just wanted to flip the house.
Right. In fact, that was how you started. You're from one of the first people that you met was a young man who, to him, you know, his house, as it is to anybody who owns their first home, it was everything. And the bank simply took hold of it, kicked him out, you know, threw out his possessions, and didn't even allow him to negotiate his mortgage. He didn't get the same treatment or even a little bit of the same treatment that the banks got from the government. How do we even grasp that in this country that is supposed to be the richest country in the world, that someone just gets kicked out of the home that they own because a bank is just not interested in helping them keep it?
Well, you know, it, again, it's always been this struggle of aristocracy against democracy. This country was founded by white landowning men who thought only they should be allowed to vote. And to this day, we still see that same dynamic played out when we have no problem with voter fraud, but we have these voter ID laws in every state to prevent voter fraud, when in reality, they're just there to depress the votes of college students, low-income folks, and seniors, all of whom might not have an official state ID handy. It is a way of depressing the vote and denying people's right. And we've seen this all throughout the history of this country. It's a struggle that goes onward. What we've seen in the last 35 years has been a systematic demantling of everything President Roosevelt achieved in the New Deal. And both parties are culprits in this. So, you know, the question the film puts is twofold. On the one hand, if government policies got us into this mess, and we haven't had inequality this great since the eve of the Great Depression, if government policies got us into this mess, could government policies get us out of this mess? And the other question is, will the 0.01%, the tip top of the aristocracy, the people who really own this country and own the politicians, would they be willing to take a smaller slice of an expanding pie instead of going on taking a larger slice of a shrinking pie? Those are some of the questions the film sets out to answer.
Right. Tell us about the young woman you met who, at a very young age, had a child, ended up working in fast food. You point out in your film that there used to be that fast food jobs were something that high school kids did in the summer, something to, you know, earn a little extra pocket money. These days, increasingly, it's adult Americans who find themselves in these jobs, often stuck in them for years, and often simply not still being able to make ends meet. Tell us about this young woman you met.
Half of them are single parents as well.
Right.
You know, that was a woman named Fiore Vasquez, who we met on our second day of shooting in a town called Central Falls, Rhode Island. This was a city that is one of the smallest cities and one of the smallest state in our smallest state. And when they declared bankruptcy, it took a terrible toll on the entire town. Fiore is a woman who grew up in an abusive household at age, I guess it was 16, 15, got pregnant and thought, this is my way out. He'll marry me and I'll have a way out, as so many young women who grow up in poverty believe. Of course, that was not to be the case. And when we met Fiore, she was living in an apartment in Central Falls where she supported her children, including her newborn grandchild and her disabled boyfriend. She was supporting six people as a 32-year-old grandmother, riding public transportation 2 hours each way to work a minimum wage job in a bankrupt town. And because she took food stamps, there are people I know who would call this woman lazy. You know, the thing about food stamps is if you're angry about food stamps, you have to be in favor of a living wage. Because when we pay for those low-cost dollar menu items or the low prices at Walmart, very often you're paying twice for those things. First at the cash register, and you know this very well, Sonali, then again on April 15th, when our taxes pay for the billions of dollars in SNAP benefits that go to these families because the employers refuse to provide their staff with living wages.
Right.
So we get these cheap prices more than once in this country.
And then you went to Sing Sing Prison, which was actually an even more hopeful place than you imagined. Why was it hopeful? Tell us about some of the people you met inside the prison who, you know, might have ended up there because of their own, the circumstances they were born into, such as deep poverty, but were trying, you know, despite the greatest obstacles, to find a way out of it.
You're exactly right. You know, we used to have about 350 college programs in prisons in this country. And in the early 90s, after the Republican takeover, Congress cut funding for prison education programs. And the number of prison colleges went from 350 to about a dozen. Sing Sing's is independently funded. And the fact is, and this is a fact, that for every dollar we spend on prison education, we save $5 on re-incarceration costs. So it seems like it's just a good conservative policy to spend a little money here to keep these guys out of jail again. But of course, as you know, any society that keeps building more for-profit prisons is a society that needs more crime.
So let's also talk about the ways in which people are attempting to revive the American dream, make it better apply to all Americans. You speak with Reverend William Barber. He's been a guest on our program, and he's become this very important national figure for leading protests in his state of North Carolina, these Moral Mondays actions to counter the extreme right-wing tilt in his state. You point out that our conservative versus liberal break in our government thinks that, you know, has this polarization where one side thinks that government programs cause poverty, the other side thinks that government programs alleviate poverty, and it's the former that has taken hold of the North Carolina legislature. How is William Barber, Reverend William Barber, countering that?
Well, as you guys well know, and I'm sure your viewers know all about Moral Mondays, and to me, it's one of the reasons why William Barber is a lot more than the fellow who gave the best speech at this year's Democratic Convention. I come from a Catholic social justice background. My father was a Franciscan brother. My mother was a nun and a nurse. My mom worked with lepers in the jungles of Africa in Malawi. And I grew up with a notion that Christianity was about the teachings of Matthew 25, that the burden on individuals and nations is to take care of the sick, take care of the poor, and be kind to those in prison. That's where Jesus gathers the individuals and the nations together. And I assume by nations, he means societies, aka governments. You'll hear a lot of modern conservative Christian folks say, well, Jesus tells you to help the poor. He doesn't say my taxes should do it. That's a really sinister argument to me, because Jesus lived under Roman occupation in first century Holy Land, did not have democracy. So I always say to my Christian friends, we can have a government based on Christian values. Christ never talked about gay people or abortion or cutting taxes on the wealthiest Nazarenes. If you're going to follow this religion, you should vote like it and not ignore the teachings of your faith in the voting booth. And what William Barber is doing, and other clergy people who don't get a lot of TV airtime, is they are holding Christians' feet to the fire and saying how it's a lot more than just putting up a tree in your house once a year. Your religion demands you care for the poor. And if you give to your church, but then vote for policies that make the rich more comfortable and make the poor struggle even more, you're sort of undermining the very faith you claim guides you. So I think he's a real hero, and I would like to see more people in power in my country actually use the logic of Christianity to get Christians to enact the kind of agenda that will help more people, because we already know that lifting people out of poverty helps all of us. I don't know how that's going to bring manufacturing jobs back to the country. But again, the dramatically uneven income growth we've seen, I mean, under this president, this alleged socialist, you know this, the first 3 years of Obama's administration, 95% of all new wealth went to the top 1% of the population.
And we just recently found out from the WikiLeaks revelations that it was a former Citigroup executive who helped fill out Obama's entire cabinet. So it's no surprise.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we're in the golden age of modest improvement that is hailed as sweeping reform. I think if they'd called the Affordable Care Act health insurance reform instead of health care reform, they probably would have gotten farther and people would understand the dynamics better. You know, look at the health care law and how easy it is to deceive Americans. Insurance companies are evil. So the president passes a law to make them be less evil. They find new ways to be evil in spite of this law. And so people are encouraged to believe the president's evil. And it's a racket, and it works. And it's one of the reasons why, you know, the poor white folks stay that way, because you got guys like Trump on the top of the economic ladder, born on the top of the economic ladder, telling terrified middle class people struggling to stay on the middle rung of the ladder that their problems come from those poor people and those immigrants and those brown people at the bottom of the ladder, who are very often the ones propping the very ladder up. It wasn't undocumented workers hanging outside Home Depot who outsourced our jobs. And it wasn't the unions that demanded we outsource all of our jobs. It wasn't poor people on food stamps who crashed the housing market. Time and time again, we are encouraged by this culture to punish those at the bottom for the greed of those at the top. And Reverend William Barber, shows like yours make me patriotic and proud when I see people who are waking up to this and demanding a more decent society.
Right. And this election, I'm so glad you brought that up. That was to be my final question. This election, we had two possible ways it could have gone several months ago. One, which is the, you know, complete reversion under any sort of GOP nominee, Trump or anybody else. And then this possible Bernie Sanders revolution, where we might have actually done the right thing to help reverse the downward trend, the upward trend of wealth. Now, what we have is a choice between the status quo, which is what we got under Obama, or the, you know, the slow worsening of the situation, and much faster worsening under Trump, along with many other things that Trump brings. And so it really does seem to be a very sad situation if we're simply relying on our politicians. So John, finally, you interviewed 200 people in 17 states in 50 cities. What is the American dream as told to you by all of these people, and how do we go about achieving it? Because we're certainly not going to get the help of politicians. How do we go about achieving it?
Well, you're right about that. I mean, if people lead, the leaders will follow, you know? And you're right. I mean, the American dream has gone from prosperity to just scraping by, to just surviving, to just being able to make it day to day. So many folks that we talk to on our journey don't believe retirement will exist for them anymore. Obviously, we can get people more involved in democracy. Ralph Nader's fond of saying we grow up corporate, not civic. And even if you're discouraged by the two presidential candidates, your state and local elections matter a lot more than who's in the White House. For me, this election is a choice between a crude tourniquet and an open hemorrhage. And I am a person who once swore he would never vote for Secretary Clinton, and now I can't wait to pull the lever, because I go for presidents based on three reasons: policy, the kind of judges they would appoint, and empathy. So in that sense, while I have a lot of respect for Dr. Jill Stein, we already know that a vote for Donald Trump is a vote for Mike Pence to run this country while Trump plays ceremonial ruler. And Mike Pence is one of the most bigoted Americans ever to hold a governor's office in terms of his Religious Freedom Act, the freedom to believe Jesus hates the same gay folks as you. But it's interesting because it's actually LGBT people who are the reason I believe in the American dream more than ever. I moved to New York City as a teenager right at the beginning of AIDS activism in the late 80s. And that was a period where gay Americans and their allies stopped waiting for the government to come and save them and started demanding help. And gay people came out of the closet. They risked being fired with their straight allies. They demanded the government do something at a time when 20,000 Americans died before President Reagan ever even mentioned AIDS or HIV. And they did a lot of protests to make straight people very uncomfortable. They did a lot of things that made me uncomfortable, and I agreed with them. And what happened as a result of this AIDS activism? We saw the swiftest advancement for civil rights of any oppressed minority in history, indeed the most oppressed minority, because gay people are usually the most oppressed minority within every minority. We saw within a generation from AIDS activism and people coming out of the closet and demanding more to a sitting president endorsing marriage equality during a contentious re-election campaign in 2012. That's what makes me believe in the American dream, that the passion of people coming together and fighting for a common cause can create the most sweeping social change. And Sonali, it all happened because of a plague. So I think it may have to get worse in this country before it gets better. Wow. But I do believe that people will do whatever they can do to restore a new version of the American dream.
John, I know your film is showing briefly or for a while on PBS. Where can they watch it if they miss it, the PBS screenings?
Sonali, it's still screening on PBS.org. You can see it there, as well as a lot of the footage that didn't make it into the film. We thought we were making a 10-hour documentary, and it wound up being a 90-minute feature. PBS has been good enough to air a lot of our footage on their website.
Thank you so much, John, and good luck to you.
Thank you for all you do. I admire your show. I love that you have an all-female crew. And I love all the work I see out of Pacifica as well as Free Speech TV. It's really an honor to be with you.
Oh, I appreciate that. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
John Fugelsang is an actor, political comedian. His new film that we've been discussing, Dream On, follows him on a road trip across the U.S. to examine if the American dream still exists. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can sign up for our newsletter at risingupwithsonali.com to get daily emails with links to all our stories.